This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The Western world has uniformly condemned the terrorist attacks on civilians attending religious services. U.S. President Donald Trump expressed confidence that his Egyptian counterpart will handle the situation properly.
That's Latitza Hoke reporting. We'll have full details on the story coming up.
Also, at least five Somali soldiers are reported dead after a suicide bomber blew himself up at a military training camp near Mogadishu, while the humanitarian situation in Somalia continues to deteriorate at an alarming rate. And in Zimbabwe, there's a surge in HIV/AIDS infections among adolescent girls and young women.
We'll have these stories and more for you, so do stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, a three-month state of emergency took effect in Egypt today following terrorist attacks on two Coptic Christian churches yesterday. At least 45 people were killed and at least 100 injured. The group Islamic State has claimed responsibility. The Associated Press reports that elite Egyptian troops had been sent to guard key installations. The world has condemned the attacks during Palm Sunday services. The explosions occurred at a Coptic church in Tanta and in Alexandria. VOA's Latitza Hoke has more.
The first explosion took place inside St. George's Church in Tanta, about 100 kilometers north of Cairo, killing at least 27 people and wounding many others. The second one targeted St. Mark's Church in Alexandria. Eyewitnesses say police stopped the suicide bomber from entering, but his device went off outside, killing 17.
They say it happened on his way inside while he was being searched, just like we were all searched before going inside. So while they were searching him, they found something, and when he was arrested, he pushed the button and blew himself up. The two police officers were blown up, and the explosion hit the people around.
The explosions come weeks before Pope Francis plans a visit to Egypt.
I pray for the dead and the injured, and I am close in spirit to their families and the entire community. May the Lord convert the hearts of people who saw terror, violence, and death, and even the hearts of those who produce and traffic in weapons.
The Western world has uniformly condemned the terrorist attacks on civilians attending religious services. U.S. President Donald Trump expressed confidence that his Egyptian counterpart will handle the situation properly. U.S. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said we must redouble efforts against Islamic State.
Terrorism is a scourge that we must stop, and we are getting better at it. The drones have taken out many of the leaders of ISIS. We got to keep it up.
Islamic State, or ISIS, claimed responsibility for the attacks, but the Palestinian terrorist group Hamas condemned them.
The Hamas movement hopes that Egypt recovers from these wounds and wishes safety, security, stability, and prosperity, so Egypt can restore its strength and pioneering role in promoting the interests of its people and those of the Arab and Islamic nations.
Egyptian Copts, the country's biggest religious minority, are a frequent target of terrorist attacks, including arsons, assaults, and bombings. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
At least five Somali soldiers are reported dead after a suicide bomber blew himself up at a military training camp near Mogadishu. AP quotes an army spokesman as saying the bomber was disguised as a military trainee and targeted soldiers and officers who had just completed their military exercises. The attack came a day after the new Somali Army Chief General Ahmed Mohamed Jamale Irfid survived a suicide car bomb attack that killed at least 15 people near his convoy in Mogadishu. The new Somali Army Chief had just attended a ceremony at the Defense Ministry where he took over command. Most of the victims of the blast were said to be civilians who were passengers in two minibuses.
In other news on Somalia, the UN warns that humanitarian situation there continues to deteriorate at an alarming rate. As drought and potential famine hit parts of the country, the UN says massive displacement and diseases continue to spread, causing extensive human suffering and deaths. 6.2 million people in Somalia are in need of assistance. About 536,000 people have been displaced within the country since November. Last month alone, 70,000 arrived in Baidoa and 72,000 in Mogadishu, searching for food and water. Thousands of other Somalis have crossed the Kenyan border, seeking help at the Dadaab refugee camp. More than 3,800 cases of measles are reported in Somalia, along with close to 22,000 cases of acute watery diarrhea and cholera. Humanitarian agencies have managed to improve access to water for more than 1 million people.
Uganda and the UN Refugee Agency are calling for more international funding for relief services for South Sudan refugees. It is estimated that $267 million is needed for humanitarian operations. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
With an average of over 2,800 South Sudanese arriving in Uganda daily, the country is considered a major host of Africa's biggest refugee crisis. However, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, alone cannot handle the surge. Its spokesperson in Geneva, Baba Baloch, says Uganda is overwhelmed.
South Sudanese refugees are arriving in Uganda at an alarming rate. They're trying to seek shelter in Uganda. And all the facilities in Uganda are under strain. Uganda needs the world's attention to help these desperate refugees. We need countries, donors, to step forward immediately to support those in Uganda who are hosting refugees and the refugees themselves.
Bariamwesiga Robert is a refugee settlement officer in Uganda's Office of the Prime Minister. He says, as a host to the South Sudanese, Uganda follows the comprehensive refugee response framework. That means providing them with food, healthcare, and other infrastructure. But underfunding is compromising its ability to deliver some of the services.
Each refugee is entitled to 2,100 kilocalories per day, and that's what we give to these refugees. So we need resources to support these people that we've saved. We need them to engage in livelihood activities. We need children to go to school. We need women to get where to deliver from. We need infrastructure. We need very many things. And the international community has its part to play.
According to UNHCR Communications Officer Roko Nuri, the lack of international support puts in jeopardy Uganda's ability to serve as host.
Local, service delivery facility are under a lot of pressure. The numbers are growing, and more support, as you know, financial support, political support, is needed to invest in long-term solution which help both refugees and host community. Uganda is truly a role model of progressive refugee policy, and has taken a lot of steps, you know, to improve the environment to where, you know, refugees are settling this day. So Uganda must be helped, because Uganda is upholding to this international obligation towards refugees.
As part of its approach, Uganda gives the refugees plots of land for settlement and integrates them within host communities. It also includes them in national development plans. However, land and other forms of support may not be available without international support, says Uganda's Minister for Refugees and Disaster Preparedness, Engineer Hilary Onek.
The refugees who came earlier could have been given 1, 2, or 3 acres of land to occupy as a family, but today it has been reduced to nearly half an acre or less. As the number increases, we reduce the space because we have no option except giving them the size that we can afford. So we still struggle. That's why we are calling for support from other international agencies, including other countries.
The government and the UNHCR have a shortfall of more than a quarter of a billion US dollars needed to support the refugees. Humanitarian officials originally said they had expected up to 300,000 people to cross the border into Uganda. But as the situation in South Sudan grows more volatile, 100,000 more have been added to that number. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
The French news agency reports four Nigerian police officers and an army captain were shot dead yesterday in an attack on a community near Lagos. One civilian is also reported killed. A Lagos police spokesman says the gunman attacked Owutu Ishawo in Ikorodu around 1 a.m. Sunday. He says they also looted homes and kidnapped some residents. Police are searching for the gunman and the kidnapped residents.
A new report by the International Crisis Group, or ICG, warns Burundi's military is increasingly becoming politicized. It says the process began 2 years ago when President Pierre Nkurunziza ran for a third term in office. Opponents said his decision violated the Arusha Accords signed 17 years ago. Now, that agreement ended fighting between Hutu and Tutsi, ensured a two-term presidency, and integrated both groups into the government and military. Richard Montcrieff is ICG's project director for Central Africa. He told reporter William Eagle the political crisis has had a huge impact on the military, a symbol of democracy and power sharing for nearly two decades.
The political crisis has really had profound repercussions across the army. First and foremost, 2 months after the crisis erupted, so that's in May 2015, there was a coup by members of the army. That was led by people who were previously very close to the current president. So that showed how deep the fractures ran. That coup wasn't successful, but following that, a large number of troops and officers fled the country into exile, where nearly all of them remain. So that's the first sort of most obvious point. Now, there's also a point about the politicization. So a lot of people within the army were not happy about the president's decision to run for a further term. And that goes back to the Arusha Accord, because the Arusha Accord laid the foundations of the modern Burundian army. And it also laid out a series of power sharing measures, both between Tutsis and Hutus, but also between people who had fought in the bush and people who were from the old army. And the current sort of plans of the president is really to dismantle the main elements of the Arusha agreement.
Do the factions in the military break cleanly along ethnic lines, or is it more than that?
They absolutely don't break cleanly along ethnic lines. And the leader of the coup in 2015 was not only a Hutu, but he was also someone who had fought alongside the president in the CNDD-FDD rebel group during the civil war. So it certainly doesn't fall neatly between Hutus and Tutsis. You know, also, there's been numerous killings since May 2015 and right up to today of senior army officers. And the modus operandi of those killings indicates that it's army officers targeting other army officers across the divide. So we see that after the coup of May 2015, there's continuing violent factionalism within the army, and we've seen that in killings in Burundi.
Can we blame the government for that?
Well, we don't know who's actually responsible for these killings, because there's been no investigations. The government is very, very reluctant to open up real domestic inquiries into these killings, and certainly very reluctant to have international inquiries into them.
Why is the army so important to Burundi, to its future as a democracy?
Well, yeah, sure. I think there's two reasons. I think that, firstly, it is symbolic, and that's very important, because the army was a symbol for a long time of the success of the Arusha Agreement, the success of Burundian peace building, and of the new Burundi that emerged from the civil war. And a lot of people were very happy because it underwent training, it participated in peacekeeping operations, and it certainly professionalized, and that's certainly true. However, as our report makes clear, that integration papered over a certain lack of cohesion that the political crisis has now exposed. Second point is simply that the regime in Burundi is a very authoritarian regime. It operates through fear. It uses its security forces more broadly, less so the army, but the police and intelligence service, for example, to instill fear in the population in order to stay in power really at any cost at the moment. And in those circumstances, the position of the army is always an absolutely critical factor.
According to your report and your findings, what's needed to reform the army to get it back on track?
Well, let's go back to the Arusha Agreement, which, as we've been discussing, is the sort of root of what has gone well with the army over the past 15 years. And the officer corps who've undergone this training and this integration generally believe quite strongly that that's what's got them the benefits that they've seen so far. Now, at the moment, the government is drifting away from the Arusha Agreement. They're trying to unravel some of the bits they don't like. The vital thing to stop the army fracturing further is not so much actions within the army, it's to keep pushing, despite all the problems that mediation has encountered, to keep pushing for a political solution and to keep pushing for an open and free discussion on the future of the Arusha Agreement and on the future of the constitution that's free and inclusive to all parties.
That was Richard Moncrief of the International Crisis Group speaking there with reporter William Eagle.
Also in Burundi, an opposition leader says he fears for his life. It is not the first time he's raised concerns about his safety. Moses Habayarimana reports from Burundi's capital, Bujumbura.
Agathon Rwasa, the deputy speaker of the Burundi parliament, says the country's ruling party, Sendele FDD, believes he could be a political obstacle to them in the 2020 general elections.
So they want to just limit me so that they can be sure to be safe with election, coming elections. I think if they are not ready for competition, then why should they claim to be democratic?
The ruling party, CNDD-FDD, was not in a position to comment on Agathon Rwasa's accusation. Mr. Rwasa is considered as the opposition leader in the country who is critical to President Pierre Nkurunziza's government. Others have fled the country since the political crisis erupted in 2015. Reports had surfaced of kidnappings and even killings of his supporters, and now he fears for his own life.
Meetings are being held to plan how to assassinate me, either in Bujumbura or when I go up country. Of course, mainly from CNDD-FDD, the army, the police, and the intelligence.
The Burundi government says the deputy parliament speaker's accusations are not true and that had not yet reported his concerns to the security officials. Pierre Nkurikiye is the Burundi police spokesman.
He didn't give any information about his security. We suppose that he is well protected by police and army agents. And they didn't report anything about an anomalous situation of his security. So if there is any meeting about this, about him, he has to report it to the security forces.
However, Rwasa says that most security forces and bodyguards belong to the government and take government orders.
So if you are in a position to be protected by the police or any other security officers, you have but only to rely on the government side. For the case of Burundi, There is no private security company.
Violence erupted in Burundi in April 2015, after President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term in the office. Violent protests led to more than 500 people losing their lives. Hundreds of thousands have been displaced. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
In Zimbabwe, there's a surge in HIV/AIDS infections among adolescent girls and young women. The National AIDS Council of Zimbabwe says those affected include young women and girls and men 50 years of age and older. The council says complacency and poverty could reverse gains the country has made in the fight against the disease. Godwin Mangudya reports from Harare.
Health officials say over the last 10 to 15 years, there's been a remarkable decline in new HIV infections and the successful suppression of the amount of the virus in the blood of infected older adults. But the surge in new infections among adolescent girls and young women is worrying, Dr. Tapiwa Magure, Chief Executive Officer of the National AIDS Council, says the resurgence could threaten years of progress in curbing the disease. He blames poverty for the increase in new infections among adolescent girls and young women, many of whom are having sex with older men.
It's with a heavy heart that as we fight hard to end AIDS by the year 2030, our adolescent girls, young women remain at a very high risk of contracting HIV. And this is made worse by the position that women occupy in our society. I think we have seen some of those causes: poverty, lack of access to education, and some of our religious and cultural beliefs.
Of the 62,000 new HIV infections in 2015, nearly 14,000 were girls and young women aged 15 to 24. The health ministry says it is already working on a program to reduce HIV prevalence in this age group. The program, which is funded by USAID, is called DREAMS, Determined, Resilient, Empowered, AIDS-Free, Mentored and Safe Women. It is being implemented by government in partnership with the National AIDS Council and other non-governmental organizations. Gertrude Nguwe, an HIV prevention coordinator in the health ministry, says the program aims to empower girls and young women through interventions. They include HIV testing and counseling, access to family planning services, and providing resources to keep them in schools.
We need to close the tap of new infections, like our minister always says. And the tap of new infections, it has actually been shown that the tap of new infections is actually amongst our key populations and our adolescent girls and young people.
Evidence shows that HIV infection among adolescent and young women could be reduced by 70% if they are kept in school, their families are strengthened, and they have access to HIV testing and counseling services. So far, more than 200,000 highly vulnerable girls have received support, including assistance to stay in school, psychosocial support, vocational training, and help starting small businesses. In Zimbabwe, nearly 1.5 million people are living with HIV, including 77,000 children. The country has the fifth highest HIV prevalence in sub-Saharan Africa, with 29,000 disease deaths. Reporting for VOA, this is Godwin Manguja.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I am your host Shaka Sali. Every Wednesday night, the Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the Anglophone crisis in Cameroon. The nation's English-speaking minority regions say they are being politically and economically marginalized by the Francophone government. Cameroon politics, an in-depth discussion on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30. UTC.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of the Voice of America's African Beat. splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical journey. I guarantee.